John Hickenlooper took an unusual path to becoming Colorado's Democratic governor. He started out as a geologist, but when he found himself laid off back in the 80s, he opened a microbrewery in Denver. Wine Coop, the first brew pub in Colorado, played a key role in some downtown redevelopment and made him a popular business owner. He became Denver's mayor and then its governor back in 2011. Today, Colorado's unemployment rate is 2.3%. That's the lowest in the country. Affordable housing and homelessness remain challenging. This week, Governor Hickenlooper and Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich have been in Washington fighting the Republican health care plan. He's back now in Colorado for the Aspen Ideas Festival and joins us here at Aspen Public Radio. Governor John Hickenlooper, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Joshua. Thanks for having me on.
So how was your trip to Washington?
It was great. And Governor Kasich, and I give him tremendous credit for having the courage to stand up against his party that really is trying to drive through a health care bill through the Senate that is really just focused on a tax cut. I mean, that's a campaign promise. I can't find a single way it actually makes our health care system better, cover more people, improve quality. All it seems to do is really transfer costs to states and, you know, rip back coverage. People say up to 22 million people will, you know, over the next 10 years lose their coverage. That's a staggering thought.
It's interesting that you, a Democratic governor, and Mr. Kasich, a Republican governor, went to Washington together, but polling shows that there's some real bipartisan opposition to this bill in many quarters. Where do you see the most prospect for a way forward to actually reforming healthcare? Are there certain grown-ups in the room who are working on this, so to speak? Are there certain policies that you think that the Democrats and the Republicans could work together on? Where's the way forward?
Well, I think the present bill coming before the Senate, or at some point will come before the Senate, was made in secret by a small group of Republicans. No Democrats were involved. That is the wrong way. So our sense, Governor Kasich and I, what we're pushing is a bipartisan team of senators who have an inclination, a desire to work in a bipartisan way, and get a couple governors in there. We're the ones who have to implement this law. Why not have governors, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with the senators, and we can work together? Governors have a great track record of working together. This would get us real results. I'm absolutely convinced. You gave us 6 months or 9 months. It would be hard. There are a lot of things we disagree on. There's a lot of funding issues that would be tough, but we would be able to get to a less political solution.
What would be best for Colorado? Give me one example of something you would like to see for Coloradans in whatever the healthcare reform might be.
Well, I want to make sure that we don't roll back coverage, and I think that's very, very important, not just in Colorado, but nationwide. Colorado, if we took the Senate bill and that became law, we would lose somewhere over 200,000 people that have coverage now. If you look at, and I've heard a lot of these cases, people with disabilities, you know, people that have chronic diseases, when they lose coverage, boy, their life really becomes challenging. The pressures become enormous. And there's a study out of Harvard that describes they think in the next 10 years there would be over 200,000 fatalities. So you're actually forcing states to kind of create death squads, is what the Republicans used to call a committee that would, you know, look at who lives and who dies. I mean, some people just aren't going to have coverage, and yet we know they need it.
Are there specific aspects maybe of the Affordable Care Act as it's currently implemented that you think bear the most improvement? From the beginning, it was always said that this bill isn't perfect, but it's a good start. Where would you like to see the reform effort start in terms of what would be best for Colorado?
Well, when you look at the exchanges where people are, you know, going out there who, in many cases, they can't get health care from where they work. They're trying to get private health care, but cost is a real problem. The subsidies have helped, but one of the problems within the exchanges is, since people with pre-existing conditions cannot be denied insurance, people don't get insurance until they get sick. And then they say, hey, I've got a pre-existing condition, I need health care. And then all of a sudden, you know, if you don't have everybody in the pool, also the only people who are ever using their health care insurance are people that are suddenly sick and need an operation, then the costs skyrocket. So there have been a lot of discussions about how do we get people to stay in the insurance pool so it's fair for everybody. And there are some Republican solutions, some Democratic solutions. Give us a few months to kind of work through the pros and cons of all these different suggestions, and we'll find a compromise.
Well, we're going to catch our breath for just a moment. moment, and then we'll continue our conversation with Colorado's Governor John Hickenlooper. We'll talk a little bit more about the Affordable Care Act, as well as Colorado's gangbusters economy and some of the other efforts to improve the environment. A corridor for electric vehicles has recently made the news. We'll talk a little more about that. Please do send us your questions for Governor Hickenlooper, Hickenlooper1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. We're back in a minute on our last day here in the beautiful state of Colorado. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with a program we're working on about religious diversity. The Smithsonian is about to open an exhibit on the religious objects that Americans have created throughout our history. Some of these objects have been controversial. Just this week, a man was arrested in Arkansas for driving his car into a stone monument of the Ten Commandments. And it's not the first time he's done this kind of thing. What personal object do you have that embodies your beliefs or your faith? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. Tell us a story about an object of faith that you hold dear. 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We'll speak to the curator of the Smithsonian's new exhibit, and we'll share some of your stories next week on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Colorado's Governor John Hickenlooper. We welcome your questions for him before our time is up. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Governor Hickenlooper, there was a point you wanted to make about rural health care in Colorado.
Yeah, I just think that when you look at some of the negative consequences that this proposed Senate health care bill would create, a lot of the real problems are concentrated in rural parts of Colorado, rural parts of America. In Colorado, we have certain rural counties where over 50% of the population is on Medicaid. And so if you roll back Medicaid, you're doing creating a real problem with their Medicaid coverage. At the same time, these plans cut resources for the already limited health care clinics and hospitals in rural America. Then you tie that in with, you know, the increasing cost that would, the burden that would be put on older citizens. So people from 50 to 60 to 65 would have to pay a larger proportion of their costs than they do presently. That all concentrates in rural parts of Colorado and America. And I think it's something that hasn't been talked about, but people, I keep urging all the folks in rural America who voted for Donald Trump to call him, to call the White House and say, hey, this is not what we intended.
Tim in Virginia tweeted, if you and the people of Colorado think health care should be free for low-income citizens, why don't you just raise your taxes and provide that service?
So we have raised our taxes to a certain extent, but in almost every state right now, there is a tremendous pressure to not only to not raise taxes, but to reduce them. And in Colorado, I could not get certain parts of our legislature to even let us put a sales tax increase on the ballot. The Republican parts of members of the state Senate thought that was just too negative an idea. And historically, issues like this where some basic level of healthcare coverage, and I don't mind negotiating, all right, say perhaps what we provide to Medicaid recipients should be lower in some way. I get that. I'm open. John Kasich, very conservative Republican governor, he and I had a bunch of frank discussions that how can you get waivers and try to help states lower their costs? But you don't want to set up a system where two states next to each other, Kentucky and Tennessee, are competing to see who can have the lowest taxes and really reduce the less advantaged families, reducing their health care. And by doing so, somehow get an economic advantage by lower taxes, getting more businesses. That's a nightmare for the country. So I think that basic what Medicaid does has always been a national mission, And I think that mission has to step, and what Obamacare did was really push that mission another step forward.
Let's talk about Colorado's economy. It's doing really well. Unemployment is 2.3%, which is an all-time low, and it's the lowest in the country. U.S. News and World Report ranks Colorado first among all states for economic stability and potential. What's going on in Colorado? What are you doing right?
Well, we started working back 15 years ago when I became mayor.
Mayor of Denver.
And we focused on quality of life and entrepreneurs and trying to make this the best place in the country to start a business. So we did quality of life things like adding bike trails. Metro Denver now has over 1,000 miles of bike trails. The state has over 20,000 miles. Live music venues. We provided incentives for more live music venues. Red Rocks, our beautiful amphitheater, went from 32 concerts a year to now 135. We want to be a magnet, but we also reduce red tape and bureaucracy and try to increase access to capital, all things important to young entrepreneurs. We've done that same thing, those same principles, in the 6.5 years I've been governor.
Now, see, it's interesting. I pause on that for a second. Sure. It's interesting that you mention reducing regulations. I understand that your administration went through like more than 16,000 of them and either—
22,000.
22, no, that's more than 16, 22,000, and either streamlined them or got rid of them. That sounds like the kind of thing that you hear from a number of conservatives in various parts of government, Republicans saying regulations are too onerous, they need to be streamlined. From hearing you say it, it sounds like that's one of those things that doesn't have to be tied to a particular party or ideology, but
exactly,
can just be done to make things easier.
Well, and we're in an age where so many baby boomers are retiring. We can actually make city government, state government, federal government, why not, but make government smaller and yet still do more for people. So the 7 years I was, 7.5 years I was mayor of Denver, we reduced the workforce by 7%. But at the same time, we created so many more jobs by getting rid of red tape, attracting these entrepreneurs, that we more than compensate. I mean, we created 10 times more jobs than we diminished in city government. And most Americans, Republicans and Democrats, do think government is too big, that it should be smaller. So that's not Republican or Democrat, getting rid of red tape and bureaucracy. Now, we do believe that you need a strong regulatory framework. We were the first state to get the environmental community together with the oil and gas industry and over the course of 11 months create what we call methane regulations. But they have to go out and go to every well several times a year in the beginning. But once a well has proven itself to be clean and there are no emissions coming out, what we call fugitive emissions, I love that phrase, they don't have to come back all the time. So, you know, that regulatory framework, which the oil and gas industry was a partner in creating, has no red tape in it, no wasted forms to fill out. And we know that every dollar that the oil and gas industry spends, which is started out at $60 million a year, is going to make our air cleaner.
And just by way of clarification for people, explain how big oil and gas is in Colorado.
So oil and gas, Colorado, like a lot of Western states, has a great concentration of oil and gas. It's probably got about a $40 billion a year economic impact, somewhere north of 70,000 jobs, I think. I forget the exact number, but it's a big player. But we also have a responsibility to make sure if they're in our community, their social contract requires that they not make the air worse, not make the water worse. And at least in Colorado, the industry has stepped up.
There are plenty of communities across the country. Maybe the most stark example of this has been in the San Francisco Bay Area, where these boom times make for all kinds of other social ills. Gentrification,
sure.
Homelessness is run amok, finding a place to live is ridiculous, and people have to move further and further out from where they live until they just have to leave. How do you prevent Colorado from becoming the next Bay Area, from becoming a place where the cool kids can't afford to live anymore and the rich can just kind of squeeze people out?
It is the major problem. It's a consequence of if you're really going to focus on jobs and getting entrepreneurs to start businesses in your community and you succeed, suddenly, I mean, affordable housing is the housing we built 60 years ago. It's smaller, it's kind of falling apart, it's a little bit run down, but it's what people can afford. If suddenly you've got all these new jobs and new people moving in and they're getting paid more money, they're going to take those smaller houses and gentrify them. They're going to make the rooms bigger. They're going to make them moderate. They're going to make them a lot more expensive. And so we've been seeing that for about the last 10 or 12 years. And anywhere where you have the kind of growth that we've had, the kind of success, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, even New York and Boston, you see real problems with chronic homelessness on the streets. You see affordable housing, as you were describing. People have to move further away from where their jobs are. So we're trying to figure out, how do you provide the incentives to the people that are building housing to make sure that they put 10 or 15% of every project has to have affordable working people's housing.
Now, is that in the law now? I know in places like San Francisco, for example, there's the requirement to build that housing, but developers could also like pay into a fund that is supposed to let other housing be built elsewhere, but getting that money out of that fund is a political headache all its own. What's in the works now in Colorado?
Well, like most places, Colorado focuses, delegates that responsibility to the local municipalities. So City of Denver, the City of Aurora, the City of Colorado Springs all have their own plans on how they're going to address this. The state is trying to find the resources, some of it's the marijuana tax money, to help address issues around chronic homelessness, and especially where you have mental health or drug addiction issues. How do we get people the counseling and the medications, but at the same time, job training and get them into jobs? That all has to be part of the solution to this kind of chronic housing shortage.
I'm glad you mentioned marijuana tax money, because we've gotten a number of questions about that, of course. I was trying to hold off.
What a surprise.
Everyone wants to know.
What a surprise.
Zach tweeted, give us a specific example of revenue from the legal sale of marijuana having a positive impact on your state and population.
Oh, absolutely. So we spend about $10 million a year from the marijuana tax money. The marijuana tax money is about $143 million last year. That's in a $28 billion budget. So it's a drop
not
in the bucket.
Much.
But we can use it for really important things. Mental health. We have over $10 million a year towards mental health. I was just talking about the $15.2 million that's going to go to wraparound services and supportive housing for the chronically homeless. It's hard to get money for those things, and the marijuana money is perfect for that, because in some way, drugs are often a cause of exacerbating the problems that people with mental health issues have to experience that leads to chronic homelessness. So affordable housing, mental health, those are places where we're putting significant amounts of our tax revenues from marijuana, and I think to great benefit.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Amy wanted to know whether the legalization of cannabis could help other financially strapped states.
Well, I think that each state has to look at it on their own. I don't think legalizing marijuana should ever be, it shouldn't be done because you think you're going to get tax revenues and that's going to solve some of your problems. I think this is a great experiment. I tell people we need probably a couple more years to decide whether it really is successful, but certainly a lot of the problems we worried about, right, spikes in teenage usage or, you know, dramatic rises in people driving while high, we haven't seen that. Pretty much the people that weren't smoking it before it was legal still aren't. The people that were smoking it before it was legal still are. And we haven't seen a giant change in usage or anything like that. So I'm not sure we can help neighboring states, except for the ones that are trying. You know, California is now doing their transition into recreational marijuana, and they're going to learn from all of our mistakes. They're going to have new innovations, which we're going to learn from. You know, slowly, state by state, we're trying to figure this out.
I feel like there's a lot more we could talk about, but I did want to get to a few other things before our time is up. You were among a number of government leaders who were very upset after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. I understand a number of Western states are going ahead with some of their own climate plans, including a vehicle charging corridor for electric vehicles between, I believe it's Colorado, Nevada, Utah, a few other states. How is that effort going in terms of climate policy in governor to governor?
So governors are where it happens, right? Governors, the buck stops on my desk. And governors work together, right? Governor Herbert in Utah is a conservative Republican who has become a great friend. I have the utmost respect for him. Literally, I would do almost anything for him. I just think he's a wonderful person. And the same thing, Brian Sandoval in Nevada. I think a very conservative person and a conservative Republican, but boy, does he care about the people of his state, and he's not afraid to make difficult decisions. So we're all working together to see if we can figure out a way that we could, you know, every 50 miles get a charging station. Each of us are looking at the impacts of climate change on our communities, more forest fires, air quality. All of our Western states are a little higher than the Eastern states, so when the air is a little thinner, that quality of pollution, the quality of your air a small amount of pollution has a much bigger effect, much bigger negative effect. So we really are, certainly in Colorado, I think most of the states, trying to look at how do we close some of these coal plants. But we're very conscious we're not going to raise, even by a penny, the cost to our utility customers, right, the ratepayers. And I think that's important to say, if we can get cleaner air without increasing hurting their household budgets, we're going to do it.
I also have to ask you about your path to the governor's office. I wonder if you reflect sometimes with a little bemusement about the journey that you've taken. I mean, geologist to laid off geologist to brewer to mayor to governor. Well, how do you reflect on your journey?
Well, obviously, when I ran for mayor, I was 50 years old. I'd never run for even student council. My journey, there's nothing I never thought about or even considered that I'd ever run for office. I was just doing what seemed to be the most, what was in front of me. And I think in a funny way, the success we've had is partly because I'm not a politician, and there is I'm an entrepreneur and someone who had started businesses. I was out of work for 2 years. I know what it feels like when you get outsourced, and not only is there no job for you, your whole career that you've worked and studied for, you've worked in 5 years, it's gone. So I was, you see a different person in the mirror. In a funny way, that experience makes me very relevant right now for all the people that have been left behind.
Two more quick things I want to ask you. Since you were a business person, there's been a lot of talk about running government like a business. As an entrepreneur, do you think that that's a wise strategy, briefly?
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can bring into government, treating your citizens like customers. In restaurant business, you learn there's no margin in having enemies. You never let someone leave that unhappy, whereas politicians define themselves by their enemies and how they attack them.
Right.
But I think they're very different. And so it takes a long time to figure out how can you take the lessons of business into government.
And of course, have to ask, someone was going to ask, Lucky tweeted, when are you running for president?
We're working on some workforce stuff here. We're working on, again, the economic development things. We're going to make Colorado the healthiest state in America.
I get the sense you're having more fun being governor.
The moment I start talking about running for president, the moment I have a pack or suddenly I get distracted, my staff gets distracted, and all this great stuff we're doing, it won't get done. And we're going to focus on the last, 550 days and run it right to the very end.
Well, we appreciate you taking time out of that race to spend some time with us. John Hickenlooper is the governor of the beautiful state of Colorado. Governor, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua. I enjoyed it.
We are also grateful for spending this week at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Here at Aspen Public Radio, we could not have gotten a warmer welcome from the folks here at Aspen Public Radio. Thank you so much for hosting us this week. Remember, you can subscribe to 1A's podcast on the NPR One app, on iTunes, or whatever app you like. We'd love it if you'd write us a review. You'll find even more great programs online at npr.org/podcasts. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I am out next week, but until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson in Aspen, Colorado. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.